TED Audio Collective.
It's TED Talks Daily. I'm Elise Hu. So many of us have spent this pandemic in front of our screens, on video chats and meetings, and of course, on Netflix. Today, we have the co-CEO of Netflix, Reed Hastings, in a condensed version of his 2020 conversation with head of TED, Chris Anderson. He talks about how he learned to become a good leader by becoming more candid, the philosophies that guide Netflix's success, and what's next for the way we live on screens. If you want more on Netflix after this, check out a recent episode of another podcast from TED called 20,000 Hertz, where they break down the iconic da-dum sound before every Netflix episode.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Support for TED Talks Daily comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/TED Talks. That's odoo.com/TED Talks. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Like TED Talks? You should check out the TED Radio Hour with NPR. Stay tuned after this talk to hear a sneak peek of this week's episode.
Reed Hastings, what a delight to get to speak with you.
Oh, it's a treat to be here, Chris. Wish it were in better times. We'll make the best of it.
I want to check in with you, first of all, about just how Netflix has done during the pandemic. Everyone assumes, I think, that it's been a time of massive success for you. Everyone's suddenly got all this time to watch your content.
You know, during the first half of the year, we did grow from 170 million roughly to 195 million. So, you know, it's good growth. Like Amazon, we're busy and we're super proud just to be part of people's escape and to be able to give them a little bit of pleasure in these very difficult times where people are stuck at home.
And beyond the growth in subscribers, what's been the growth in actual hours viewed?
Oh, pretty similar. I mean, the first 2 weeks, there was a big shock factor where nobody left the house at all. I think now, even though people are quarantined, they're, you know, living more full lives. We've got sports that's on a little bit. So pretty normalized now.
Reed, tell me a bit more about you before you founded, co-founded Netflix. What was the story before then?
Unremarkable kid. Went to college and found I really loved mathematics, but I didn't really want to be a professor, so I became a math teacher in the U.S. Peace Corps. Loved that super rural part of Southern Africa. Came back, and the lucky break of my life was getting into Stanford grad school in AI 30 years ago. And it was a very different AI than today, but it set off a lifelong curiosity about humans, technology, how it all comes together. Then I got super lucky again and created a very technical software company in the 90s that did well. And that was my evolution from engineer to CEO. I had never managed a person at all. And then suddenly I was CEO of this company because I had the first idea. That company doubled every year for 6-7 years. Morgan Stanley took us public in 1995. It was a big deal at the time, but I was not a very good CEO. Good product person, so we kept growing. But as a leader, pretty rough. And Netflix for me has been redemption. It's been a chance to really refine and understand and reflect on leadership and learn so much from all the people that have written books before now. And this book, No Rules Rules, is sort of my contribution back to the system that I've learned so much from, which is other people writing books.
Well, certainly Netflix has been amazing to look at as an outsider. It's been a story of these radical shifts in strategy every few years, it seemed like. Really bold, occasionally almost reckless. There was a switch from being a mail, movies delivered on DVD and returned to streaming, which was a little awkward in how it happened, but was so important and key to your future. But then an even more surprising shift for me was, a little more than 7 years ago, when suddenly you started producing your own content, like House of Cards. When that deal was announced, I think a lot of people said, wait a second, this is never going to work. These guys are nerdy internet guys, doing a fine distribution service, licensing other people's content. But I mean, this is craziness. This is hubris, trying to create your own content. And then, wait a second, it actually worked. So talk to me about what some of that specialness is. The way you've structured this book, there's a cycle of three that's repeated each time of three different things. What are those three different things? I mean, start with this notion of talent density. What is that?
Well, if you have the right people together, amazing things can happen. So everybody tries to hire well. There's no real difference in everyone's ambition in that direction. What's different about Netflix is the keeper test. And what we say is for managers is, would their people, if they were leaving to go to another company, would we try to change their mind to keep them? We would fight to keep them. And if we fight to keep them, great. If there's someone that you wouldn't fight to keep, we say, give them a generous severance package, 4 to 6 months of compensation now, and let them go find a place that's a better match.
And when you find that great talent, you are willing to pay the absolute top of market price to get them.
Yeah, I mean, again, the economic insight is the best people perform 10 or 100 times better than the typical. And so there's a big premium in our business to getting the best people, even if it costs you twice as much, because you've got people who are many times more effective. And that's an aspect of creative work generally. The best authors, the best software writers, the best actors. It's across many industries that are creative.
It's certainly, I think it's known that in something like software writing, that a brilliant programmer really can perform 100 times better than an average programmer. And that you can have circumstances where a single programmer could outperform a team of literally 100 other programmers. But does that apply in other creative areas? Like when you talk about the exponential skills of a super talented creative person, does that mean that you literally can hire far fewer people, or is it just that the output of their work will actually be more impressive?
You can hire fewer people, so it would be better in highly creative work to have 5 people that were incredibly talented working on some given project. And that could be making a movie, it could be making a marketing campaign, could be winning an election, or it could be writing software, than 10 or 100 people who were less good. And remember, it's not just about the individual performance, it's about how the individual works with a team, because everything we do is teamwork. And teamwork is a skill. I mean, most people want it, but only a few people are so good that they know when to do a blind pass or when to reach out and let their teammate know about things.
And you actually use the word team almost in contradistinction to family. A lot of organizations, including at TED, we've sometimes used this language. We say, we're a family here. And that is supposed to generate this warm, supportive, loving culture. You've actually said, no, that's actually probably not the right metaphor. Go with teams, which are, where there's more competitive, and you are actually willing to do things that you would never do to a family member. You can't fire your sister.
No, that's exactly right, which is, you know, the family is really about unconditional love. And, you know, if your sister steals from you, you still love her. And, you know, if your brother does something awful, you still love him. And so families can be very dysfunctional, but we admire them for loyalty above all, that they stick with each other. And that's how I want to be as a family member also. But then a team is really about performance, and it's about contribution and about effectiveness with other people.
But some people read may listen to that and kind of react in shock and saying, wait a second, you're talking about inviting people to come to your company, and that they're going to be terrified the whole time that they're not measuring up, that they may have to leave. Isn't this a recipe for like a toxic work culture?
Well, again, think of athletics. You know, an athlete could get injured in any game and end their career. And do they walk around terrified? No. You know, what they do is they have the discipline to lean into the joy of play, of winning, and, you know, the hunger of the excellent teammates. And so, you know, people get used to moving forward, and they understand, if you're clear that it's a team, that not everyone will be on the team. And they maintain the friendships, and, you know, we're friends with all the people that have been cut from Netflix. And it's like an Olympic team, if you've had a friend who's been on one of those, and then they get cut. I mean, it's very sad. It's disappointing. It's heartbreaking. But there's no shame in it. I mean, to compete at that elite level, it's, you know, fantastic.
There was one other thing that you don't talk about that surprised me a bit. It just in terms of attracting and holding talent. You talk a lot about paying a lot. You don't talk much about mission. And like someone like Elon Musk would say, you know, the reason I can hire some of the world's best engineers is because, you know, they're part of the creating a sustainable future, et cetera. Is mission not just as important as how much you pay people?
No, I think it is. For us, it's entertain the world, and, you know, how do we bring people together through all of the stories that we tell? And that plays a significant role. But I think people also want to be stimulated on, they want to grow in their career. You know, there's a number of things they want. And we wouldn't want mission to be used as a way to pay people less, basically. But they're both super important.
So a second leg of your three-legged stool is candor. Talk about that. There's this unique sense of transparency to a point that would really shock some people.
Well, you know, I grew up aspiring to be kind, okay, and aspiring to be liked, and certainly not aspiring to cause pain. And so I avoided conflict. When all that time I was a bad CEO, I would, you know, never deal with conflict because I didn't want to hurt people's feelings. And my wife and I had the most amazing marriage counselor now 25 years ago. And he got me to see that I was just systematically lying about everything. Because I would say things like family is the most important thing. And then I would stay at work in the evening if some employee had a problem, and I would ignore my family. I mean, so I was just so disconnected from the reality. But relative to work, he got me to be an honesty-seeking CEO instead of a kind-seeking. And so now I can be very straightforward about performance and what's happening. And I don't like causing pain. But it's more, again, like athletic training. So your trainer is there saying, you know, give me 5 more push-ups. And that hurts, okay? But you do it, okay? And because you realize when you're exercising, that pain is helping you be stronger. It's the same thing with good feedback, with candor. is that it can hurt. And it still hurts me sometimes. But done well, it produces growth. And that's what's so stimulating.
I mean, in the book, your co-author, Erin Mayer, puts these four tough questions to you on candor. And in each case, the answers, at least to me, were quite surprising that you were willing to go there. So one of them was the instance, you're a public company, you're about to announce your quarterly results. Do you let employees internally know those numbers ahead of time, knowing that anyone who leaks that information could go to jail? Or do you do what most companies do and keep that information absolutely tightly controlled? Which way do you go?
We go open with the information at Netflix. But in my first company, of course, we spent elaborate time making sure that no one could see this and this. And we had information controls and compartmentalization. And it's like all a big power trip. And really, when you think about it, if you think about risks, there's short-term risks, which would not be good if somebody leaked the information. And there's long-term risks, which is employees understand, they feel power, they feel in control, they feel special. And organizations really have many more risks of the latter, sort of employee alienation, than they do about potentially someone leaking something. And what we get back is then this sense of commitment that they have and that they really go the extra mile because they care, because they feel it's unique.
Another example that was put to you was, okay, so what if the company is thinking about some kind of restructuring and a manager is told that several of her employees has a 50% chance of losing their job? Should that manager tell those employees that their jobs may be at risk? What's your recommendation on candor in that circumstance?
To lean into the candor and to tell the employee with the potential job losses about it and to get their opinion on it and involve them. And we try to develop, you know, mature thinking people. And I'm not saying it doesn't scare them, it does. But on balance, they would rather be involved in the decision and then are more effective on executing it if we're, you know, changing in some way like that. So, you know, we really want people to be involved and trusted. And it is harder. You know, if you want to have a simple job where you don't have to think and you can just work, you know, 8 to 5 and have no worries, you know, we're not the right place. And if you're the kind of person that wants to grow and learn and understand more, and you're willing to be challenged in various ways, then you love Netflix.
Mm. So then talk about the next leg of the stool, the third leg here, controls. When you have these other things in place, you can afford to do something pretty radical in terms of the way that companies normally control what employees do. Talk about that.
We want our leaders to be great teachers, okay? To be, again, inspirational and not to be controlling. We're trying to get away from the factory paradigm where they set the rules, you follow them as the worker. And we're trying to really show people you don't need these controls. And some of the symbolic things in that are things like no limits on vacation. And it's really just symbolic, okay? Because it's not, again, like we beat Blockbuster, you know, or HBO because we have unlimited vacation and they don't. But it's one more aspect of trusting people. And think about it just logically. We don't know how many hours a person works in a day. Are they working 8 hours a day, 10, 12? We don't track any of that. So why should we track whether they take work for 48 weeks or work for 46 weeks, or work for 50 weeks. You know, it's in the noise. So people say, well, what if somebody takes, too much vacation? And I'm like, you know, we don't have a clothing policy, and yet people don't come to work naked. So why is that? You know, and that's because they have a cultural belief about it's appropriate to wear clothing in the office. And then the other fear potentially is that no one takes vacation because, you know, you don't know how much you could take. But, you know, I take a lot, try to set a great example that way.
So this is definitely head scratching for some people thinking about this. They go, but wait a sec. There would always be someone who would cause huge annoyance by abusing this policy and constantly taking time off. Does what happens then? That person just gets fired because they're suddenly no longer really supporting the culture? How do you avoid that?
Well, let's take a case of someone takes every other month as vacation, but they're just incredibly productive. And when they come back, they've got all these fresh ideas that like are amazing. I mean, you know, I would fight to keep that person. So it's really not about, you know, how many hours you're in the office or how much you work. It's trying to get to the contribution. And let's take a case where, you know, if someone did abuse it, sure. But again, that might be 1 in 100, 1 in 50. And the whole theory here is we're not focused on efficiency. We're focused on flexibility and inspiration.
So another control, for example, that you have let go of is expense management. There aren't really expense rules, but there is, I guess, modeling by managers. And I assume that there's some kind of understanding of what is normally okay.
Yeah, I mean, the guidance or context that we give is do what's in Netflix's best interest. So if you're flying overnight and then you're going right into the office and you've got a big presentation, it definitely makes sense to, you know, get sleep well on the flight. So think of it as it's very, makes people have to think, you know, is this the right thing to do for Netflix? And if it is, you know, they can order champagne. I mean, you know, if that's the right thing to do and entertaining some, you know, host, it's fine. We don't have to set rules about it. And, you know, on occasion, we do have people who, you know, are hugely extravagant and cheat on the system, basically. And then they're gone again. So, but you can't worry about the little mistakes or you'll get consumed with them. What you're trying to do is keep it healthy for everybody else, where it's very simple and they don't have to seek permission, you know, for each little thing.
Like, couldn't you have a variant of your policy where there are basic guidelines in place, but you say to people, look, if there are exceptional circumstances, use your judgment.
Yeah. And maybe that'll be a little bit better, you know, so other companies can try that. Or maybe they find that then once they go to one rule, like if the flight's longer than 8 hours, you could do business class. Okay. And then the question comes up, well, what about if it stops somewhere and there's a long layover? And what about if it's overnight? And what about if the business class flight's very cheap? And it's like, once you start getting into specifying rules, there's no end. It just goes on and on.
So when you put these pieces together, you have this philosophy of what you call freedom plus responsibility. It's sort of you replace the whole panoply of policies and rules and just say, you basically say, get talented people, let them do their thing, but let them own the outcome of that thing.
That's right. So you can think of it as the macro thing is use good judgment. Okay. And then for every, and then you're going to have some mistakes, but the whole point of it is those don't really matter in the success of the company over multi-decades, okay? What matters in success of the company over multi-decades is the new ideas. So the old world is sterile. Follow the rules, factory, okay? And the world we're trying to create is fertile. And it's a little bit chaotic and it's dirty and it's messy and mistakes get made, but ideas get generated and there's fresh thinking and people are independently trying to think what's good for the customers, what's good for the company, how do we grow? And that's very powerful. And it overwhelms essentially the small amount of little mistakes that come that the, all those controls are trying to serve.
So put those pieces together, Reid, and give an example of how, you know, this culture has allowed talent to be attracted and to flourish, that has been able to successfully take on, you know, the world's giant studios with all their creative talent. How on earth is it that you'd be able to come in and you know, produce content that competes? The early story I always heard was that, oh, you had all this data that they didn't have and you could see what kind of users actually wanted. How much is it that the story versus attracting genuinely brilliant creative people and empowering them?
Yeah, it's definitely not the data. So there's lots of data about what television shows people watch from Nielsen. There's lots of data of box office for film. So all of our competitors have lots of data too. That's not. The difference is we have lots of people in our content group that could make decisions. In a major studio or network, every decision gets reviewed five levels up and, you know, micromanaged. And what we do is we have lots of independent people who are then making decisions, big decisions, about what content to do and why. And some of them won't work out, okay? Some of them will be a mistake, but that's okay. And because if you get, you know, Orange is the New Black and you get Stranger Things and you get The Old Guard, you get, you know, these big successes. So it's really organized around distributing power. I talk about how a perfect quarter for me is one where I've made no decisions. All I've done is advocate, influence, inspire, because what we wanted to do is to really have the other people make the decisions.
I think I just want to end by asking you a bit about the future of Netflix. You know, we've best just been through this pandemic where many people have transferred a huge amount of time from the physical world to the virtual world. We've spent all this time on screens and Zoom meetings watching Netflix and other services. And some people say they're sick of it. I think other people are shocked by how good parts of it have been, that they, you know, wow, you know, and they've almost seen that the future could be permanently different. Could the future be permanently different? And what's the role of Netflix in this future? Are you pretty determined to keep the main focus on pre-recorded content, whether it's TV shows or movies, or are there debates and dreams afoot in the company to expand beyond that? For example, into interactivity. I think video games in general have been a huge winner in the pandemic, and a lot of people have just got lost in these sort of virtual worlds. Do you have a role to play in that or in other areas that you're dreaming about?
You know, we're really focused in the joy in people's lives and creating that sense of escape and connection that all of us use entertainment for. So not really doing news, you know, not teaching calculus. But many people find the joy from learning something new, from a documentary about an issue, from coming to understanding. And so we're definitely do a lot of documentary and nonfiction programming, and then fun things that could be real time or not, Floor is Lava, you know, and it's this competition show that's very cute. And then there's, of course, just great epic entertainment, great filmed entertainment. And today we do some interactive entertainment, so we'll do more of that. Not sure on video gaming, it's probably, you know, nothing in the short term, but, you know, maybe eventually something in that space. Right now where it's console-based and, you know, it's pretty specific in terms of who uses it.
Do you care or measure different, if you like, benefits of entertainment? I mean, there's definitely a lot of joy, a lot of sort of compulsive viewing, binge viewing that you've driven. Documentaries, you could argue, people learn from, and there's a sort of educational role. Other forms of entertainment maybe bring families together. Is there any sort of discussion internally about, like, there are certain things that you give yourself especially big bonus checks for? I don't mean literally, but, you know, like check marks for, and that you try to incent? Or is it all, you know, if it adds up to new subscribers and more hours viewing, then it's all the same? How do you think about that?
So we think about it as trying to serve our members. And if a documentary is what our member chooses it, we love it that much. And we try not to project our own particular tastes, you know, which skew somewhat elite. And say, this is good for you, and you know, this is broccoli, and this is ice cream. So, you know, we have ice cream on our service, we have broccoli, and we let people choose, you know, openly and value it by basically the proportion that it's chosen.
But don't people criticize their own choices in retrospect, as it were? So often people, like, I have a habit of choosing ice cream, whereas my beautiful wife chooses broccoli. I actually, after the experience of eating it, feel healthier after the broccoli, aka foreign language documentary whatever, than after the ice cream of some sci-fi or comedy entertainment or whatever. Do you ask people afterwards, you know, was this time well spent? Are you happy? What would you like more of this on Netflix at all? Is that a different algorithm?
It's not a different algorithm, but I would say we do try to understand satisfaction and what entertainment, like if you ask people what they remember from the past year of what they watched, and then we do try to do more on shows that they remember, okay, which made an impact, as opposed to past the time and, you know, think of it as if it was really great ice cream, and you could remember that taste of that strawberry ice cream on a summer day, then that counts for us just as much as the broccoli. So it's really about the emotional impact on the person that they can remember it.
Well, Reed, you've built an absolutely incredible company. And I think these principles are really, really powerful. I think lots of people are going to ponder what they can take from them. Thanks so much for this time. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear from you.
Awesome, Chris. Thank you.
20 years ago, Jimmy Wales founded Wikipedia as a place for everyone to share information. But he wasn't exactly sure how to run the site.
How do you put together a system that will generate a reasonable degree of quality and, you know, be open?
Ideas about building communities, online and off. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Subscribe or listen to the TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.